good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path Radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour, as we are essentially every weekday afternoon, and we take your calls during this time. You can call in with questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or you can call in with disagreements. Now, by the way, questions and disagreements, that's what I usually announce, that you can call in with, and you certainly can. I might add, if you have a personal criticism of me, I don't mind hearing it on the air. I say that because somebody started writing to me yesterday and has written to me several times. Doesn't know me at all, but he's quite sure that I've got secret darkness in my life, and that I'm one of the rich, you know, one of the woe to the rich, and that I'm working for filthy lucre. So, in other words, for money. I'd love this when I got to call me up and say those things, because those things are so, out of touch. I've never charged for any ministry I've ever done. I don't receive anything for being on the radio. I don't receive anything when I travel and speak, except whatever maybe people put into a jar in the back, but I never ask for any money. But the funny thing is that there's people out there who they assume certain things because they don't like whatever your teaching is. I don't know what this guy doesn't like about my teaching, but he just decided I'm a bad guy. And I don't mind getting some of those calls. I mean, honestly, I think I wouldn't want the show to be full of those kind of calls. But if someone has personal problems with me personally, I don't mind you calling up. But primarily, it's to call with questions about the Bible or maybe disagreements about the Bible. And the number to call, in any case, is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Now, it's not too early to announce that listeners in Arizona, and we have many listeners in Arizona, I'm going to be in the Phoenix area for a few days speaking in various places. And that's going to be this month, the 18th through the 21st, I'll be in the Phoenix area. That is, of course, that's 4 days speaking different places. So if you are in the Phoenix area and would like to attend any of the places that I'll be speaking, you can find out where and when they are by going to our website, thenarrowpath.com. That is thenarrowpath.com. And looking under the tab that says announcements, you can find out where I'll be speaking, and I would be glad to see you and meet you there. All right. Well, we've got quite a few calls waiting. There's one line open. So if you'd like to occupy that line, the number is 844-484-5737. Our first caller we're taking today is going to be from Pendleton, Oregon, and that's Eli. Hi, Eli. Welcome. Well, your line is activated. Are you there, Eli? I don't know if we have a problem in the studio or if he has a problem with his phone. But we can't have dead air. So I'm going to hang up, and Eli, if you call back, I don't know if you've got a problem with your phone or if you're on a dead channel for us. We have other channels. Maybe if call back and maybe you'll get on another line. I don't know if that's the problem or not, but I would love to hear from you. All right, let's talk to Jason from Beaverton, Oregon. Jason, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, it's great to be on here. By the way, mm-hmm. It's funny to hear you start the program with some guy kind of accusing you of the money stuff, where I would criticize you because you don't ask for money enough. I've been benefited from your ministry for almost 10 years, and you hardly ever speak about it. So I just want to say it's just hilarious someone would say that, because you are some of the most generous guy in terms of what you offer without asking people in return. But
before you go further, we do, appeal for funds for the radio show.
Yeah.
At the end of each show. But, of course, none of that goes to me because I don't receive anything for it. But, yeah, when I appeal for funds at the end of the show and say, if you want to donate, here's the address, that money, if people donate, it goes to buying radio time, and there's really nothing else that it goes to.
Yeah. Well, you are obviously among all the different voices I hear on the radio, you're among the least who actually do make the ask, and so it's greatly appreciated. My question is regarding someone just brought up the idea that the Gospels were written after the Epistles, and that didn't seem to make sense to me because I didn't think that there was enough information to make that determination. And second of all, it seemed to me like if what Jesus said was important, it actually applied to important things that people needed to know within the first decade of his resurrection, and for the disciples to wait until a few decades after to put it in writing. And I just wanted to get your thoughts.
Okay. Well, as far as we know, none of the books of the New Testament were written within the first decade after the resurrection. However, the teachings of Jesus were being publicized by the preachers. I mean, the apostles were going out publicly and preaching, and what they were preaching is the story of Jesus and his preaching. Remember, Jesus told them to make disciples of all nations, teaching them to observe everything he commanded. So his commands would be the curriculum that they preached, although they didn't put it into writing right away. Now, we don't know when the first of the Gospels was written. There are some people who believe that Mark, well, most scholars believe Mark is the first Gospel written. There's some controversy over that because church fathers thought that Matthew was the first one written. But it doesn't really matter which one was first. The point is, most scholars believe Mark was the earliest, and I don't know of anyone who would place Mark earlier than, say, 50 A.D., 50 A.D. is about the earliest date. Some would put it as late as 70 A.D. or thereabouts. I wouldn't. I don't think it belongs that late. But I would be willing to accept a 50 A.D. date. But that's, of course, 20 years after the resurrection. Now, Paul, his earliest epistles were probably written right around 50 A.D. And it's very possible that they were written shortly after that or before the Gospels. The Gospels, of course, when they came to be written down, is not as significant as how early their contents were being broadcast through the preaching of the apostles. The apostles were not primarily writers. They were primarily preachers. And a few of them eventually got around to writing down the story of Jesus. But the things Jesus taught were being, preached orally from the beginning. And remember, most people didn't have copies of books anyway. You couldn't mass produce books in those days, so only very rich people could afford to have a book because it had to be handwritten. You had to hire someone to handwrite it. That was very expensive. But in the synagogues, for example, before time of Christ, the Jews were expected to learn the law of God just from hearing it orally. They didn't really have the possibility of going home and reading a copy of the Torah because they didn't have copies of it at home. So the Jews, and no doubt the early Christians, were expected to learn the things that Jesus said primarily from hearing them preached and to remember them. But eventually, and probably it may be when some of the disciples were dying off, the original ones, they realized, well, we better put this in writing just because we may not be around that much longer. So Mark may have been the first. I believe Mark, Matthew, and Luke, although we don't know what dates they wrote, Luke almost certainly wrote around 60 A.D., certainly no later than that from the evidence. Matthew may have been written earlier or later, but all three of those Gospels were certainly written before 70 A.D. And I say they certainly were because they record Jesus' predictions about the destruction of the temple, but they don't record the fulfillment of those predictions, which was in 70 A.D. They certainly would have mentioned it. They record in detail Jesus' predictions about the destruction of the temple, and they are so fond, the writers are so fond of pointing out fulfilled prophecy, they certainly would have said, oh, and that's what happened when the Romans came, but they didn't, none of them mentioned that. So that would give very strong evidence they were writing before that event had happened. Luke was the first document written by Luke, and Acts was the second. And Acts apparently was not written any later than 62 A.D., and that was the second book. So around 60 or 61 would be a good guess for Luke. Again, Matthew and Mark probably were the earliest two, and we don't know exactly how early either of those appeared. But Paul's epistles began to appear very early, about that early. in Galatians. Galatians is probably the earliest epistle of Paul, and it would have been written around 49 A.D., because I believe all the evidence is that it was written before the Jerusalem Council, and the Jerusalem Council was in 50 A.D. 1st and 2nd Thessalonians almost certainly were the next epistles written, then the Corinthian epistles, then probably Romans. Romans would have been written around 57 A.D. So between Galatians and Romans, there were four epistles besides those two written, and they would have all been written between 50 and 57 or 58 A.D. So probably before most of the Gospels. It's even possible that Mark had not written his Gospel that early. He and Matthew and Luke may have all written their Gospels around 60. But we can't be sure. We don't know when the earliest Gospel was written. It's possible that the earliest Gospel came out around the same time as the earliest epistles.
And so when you said the early church fathers talked about Matthew, were you saying that they were just, that was the discussion, or did they actually talk about him being the first, or is it that he was among the first writings of when they were talking about who wrote
them? Well, some of the church fathers, I think, would suggest that Matthew is the first to write before Mark and Luke, but they don't necessarily say he wrote the gospel as we now have it initially. They say that he wrote a collection of the sayings of Jesus in Aramaic, and that other gospel writers would translate those into Greek. Now, the Gospel of Matthew does not exist in its original form in Aramaic. There is in the Peshitta, we have an Aramaic Gospel of Matthew, but it's almost certainly translated from Aramaic to Aramaic from the original Greek. So all the Gospels were written originally in Greek, but before the Gospel of Matthew, which we have in Greek, was written, Matthew had probably put out a first draft in Aramaic, and that's that first draft, which probably didn't have all the stories in it. I just had most of the sayings of Jesus, which is what the church fathers say Matthew wrote in Aramaic, as the sayings of Jesus. That probably became the first draft for a later Greek version of Matthew as we have it today. So it's possible that Matthew's, proto-Matthew gospel was earlier than any of the others.
Okay. I appreciate you taking my question. Thank you.
All right. I appreciate your call. God bless you, Jason.
Bye
now. Okay. Eli from Pendleton is back. I hope we can activate his call now. Hello, Eli. Welcome. Oh, no. Eli, do you have your phone muted, perhaps?
Can you hear me?
Oh, now I can. Yeah, welcome.
Okay. Thank you very much. First of all, I'd just like to say thank you for your program. Uh-huh. I really enjoy listening to your topical lecture series on when shall these things be?
Oh, yeah.
Regarding Revelation 20. Oh, my goodness. That is, I don't remember how many times I have to repeat listening the same one. It's regarding the premillennial, post, and amillennial. I don't know much about it, but I've been learning a lot about it, and I appreciate it. Now, I have one question. I hope you don't mind. So, it's regarding the issue, and I know Jesus already addressed this, regarding the issue of marriage in heaven. And I'm aware that Jesus already addressed this in Matthew 20, verse 30, and Luke 20.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand Islam contradicts Jesus in so many ways, including this topic.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Quran and Hadith, there's sex orgies going on in Islamic heaven. Matter of fact, this is one of Allah's reward for Muslim men, not so much for the women. My question is, are you aware
in other words, in Islam, what's heaven for the men is hell for the women.
Exactly. And anybody listening, they can look it up. Sunnah Ibn Majah, Book 37, Hadith 437. That's pretty clear in that one. It's pretty disgusting. Anyway, my question is, are you aware of any LDS or Mormon arguments to explain away the contradiction in their temporal marriage theology with what
you
said
point.
Already?
You've got a good point there. Yeah, both Islam and Mormonism teaches that men may have multiple wives in the next life. whereas Jesus said that in the resurrection, people don't marry and are not given in marriage. So you're asking what arguments would the Mormons give for this?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I don't know. Maybe we have an ex-Mormon who's very very articulate who listens to this show. Maybe he'll call up and answer this for us because he's much more expert on Mormonism than I am. But I think the short answer would be their teachers taught them this. And you don't need much more of an argument than that. I mean, if it's in, for example, Doctrines and Covenants or one of those official books of Mormonism, if for example, Brigham Young taught something like this, then they wouldn't need any more arguments. It'd just be like we open a Bible and quote a Bible verse. For us, that settles it. For them, in many cases, it would settle it to quote one of their prophets, Joe Smith or Brigham Young or someone else authoritative. So they wouldn't, in that case, need any arguments. They just need a relevant citation. But, of course, if somebody does teach that there is marriage in the next life, they do have to bump up against what Jesus said against it. And I'm not sure how they would do so. I don't know if they would just say, hey, well, you know, I don't know what Jesus meant, but I know Brigham Young said so-and-so, or, you know, someone else like that.
Yeah.
That's the way that's the way it is with cults. I mean, cults say they believe the Bible, but what they really mean is we believe the Bible as it is interpreted and expounded by our cult leader. And so it doesn't mean they really use the Bible. It means they'll use the Bible insofar as the cult leader uses the Bible. Otherwise, they'll go with him.
Hey, hopefully there's a Mormon out there listening in who could call in and explain it. Because I don't remember hearing any arguments to explain away that contradiction.
Right, and I don't know what they would say about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And Steve, I also believe that in their theology, God used to be a man in a planet Kolob. Kolob, is that right?
I think that's what they called it, yeah.
And then he became... And so that's why they take this literal explanation of we are the children of God. And anyway, but I would like to hear what their argument about that.
Yeah. Well, Brigham Young.
I appreciate it.
Oh, sure. Sure. God bless you. Brigham Young succeeded Joseph Smith as the leader of the movement, the Mormon movement, and both of them were considered to be prophets of God. And Brigham Young said some outrageous things that I think Joseph Smith never said. And I don't know if Joseph Smith would have even agreed with, but Brigham Young said that God was once a man like us. He means Adam in the garden, and that he came to the garden with Eve. And the way Brigham Young said it, Eve was one of his celestial wives, and they began to populate the planet so that we are, you know, we're descended from God and Eve. And God was, of course, they would say the God of the Bible, and Eve would be one of his I guess, multiple celestial wives. This, of course, doesn't have any connection to solid biblical teaching on any of that subject. So, again, like I said, cults don't really need to prove their point from the Bible because there's an authority above the Bible in their system, and that's whoever the cult leader is. So, you know, they can say any outrageous thing they want, even contradicting the Bible. And, you know, to the person who's devoted to the cult, they've got to go along with it, or else they're disloyal to the prophet of God, as they would say. All right. I appreciate your call, brother. Delita from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi. Hello, Pastor Steve. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you.
Yes, I'm doing well myself. Thank you. I have a question from 2 Kings chapter 20.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's one of those chapters in the Bible that's just always puzzling for me. It is a beautiful chapter, but at the same time, I often wonder if God knew that Ezekiah would anger him in the end, why did he grant him 15 more years on his life to the point where he had a son, Manasseh, who was just so cruel, you know? And it's the reason why I called in about this question, because I'm one of those persons who believe that I can pray and ask God to remember me, remember my faithfulness, you know. But when I think about this chapter, I'm very careful now with my prayers because if God knows all things, my faith and his words can change the destination of my life for what I'm asking for, but I wouldn't want God to give me something that will anger him in the end. So I don't know if you understand my question.
Of course.
You could just clarify that for me, and I'll just listen. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your call. I think you make a profound observation. But for listeners who don't know what she's talking about, in 2 Kings chapter 20, we read that Hezekiah got sick. He was the king of Judah, and he was a good one, too. But he was sick, mortally sick. He was going to die. And Isaiah the prophet came to him and said, get your house in order because you're going to die of this sickness. Now, Isaiah left, and Hezekiah prayed, and he asked God to, you know, have mercy and extend his life and so forth. And so God said, oh, okay. And so Isaiah was told to come back and tell Hezekiah, okay, God heard your prayer. He's going to let you have 15 more years. So his life was extended for 15 years. Now, if Hezekiah had died at the time that it was originally announced that he would have died childless. He had no son to succeed him to the throne. However, 3 years after he was healed of his sickness, he had a son named Manasseh. And then, of course, Hezekiah died at the predicted time after 15 years, and his son Manasseh was 12 years old and became king. King Manasseh was the worst of all the kings of Judah. He was the most wicked. He sacrificed his own babies, his own sons, to the prophet Moloch. He killed Isaiah the prophet, sawed him in two. He was just a wicked, cruel, perverse king. Now, according to 2 Chronicles, Manasseh eventually repented. He was carried away into captivity, and he turned around and turned his heart to God. God got him restored to his throne, and Manasseh began to make reforms and had, he kind of undid some of the bad things that he had done. Though his own son, who had been raised in idolatry, simply returned the nation to idolatry after Manasseh was dead. So the net effect of Manasseh's reign was very wicked and very bad for the country. Now, you're asking, why did God extend Hezekiah's life if God knew that Manasseh was going to be born then and do this harm to the country? Well, the Bible says in the book of Psalms, it says, he gave them their request, and with it leanness of soul. Now, what it means is that God sometimes gives people what they ask for, but it's not what turns out to be for their good. And I guess he does that to teach us lessons. Now, here's a question. What if I'm sick and I pray for God to heal me? Is it possible that God would heal me and it would end up being disastrous like it was for Hezekiah? Well, I think you're saying that's making you kind of afraid to pray for that kind of thing for yourself because, you know, maybe if God healed you, maybe if you... You know, if he grants your request, it may be a bad thing in the end. But remember, before Hezekiah prayed, Isaiah the prophet, speaking for God, said, prepare your house because you're going to die. In other words, God had informed and revealed to Hezekiah that it was God's will for him to die at that time. Now, Hezekiah, I believe, should have been content and said, okay, I'm going to die sometime. I now know what God's will is. I'm going to die of this sickness shortly. And, you know, we should always be resigned to live or die in God's timing, because we're going to live or die in some time. We're going to die sometime. And if God said this is the time, well, I mean, if a doctor told me you're going to die in 3 weeks, I'd say, okay, I knew I was going to die sometime. Now the mystery is solved. It's going to be 3 weeks from now or less. That'd be fine. I'm ready to die. And Hezekiah should have been too. But instead of submitting to the will of God, he prayed that God would change his mind. That's kind of what happened when the people came to Samuel and said, give us a king to rule over us. And they knew it wasn't God's will to do so, but they're asking him to anyway. And Samuel prayed about it, and God said, well, go ahead and give them what they want. Warn them. It's going to be bad for them to have a king. But and don't feel bad, Samuel. They're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. but we're going to give them their request. And it turned out badly. It was bad to have a king. So, you know, this is sometimes the case that people who are, they know what God's will is because God has told them, but they don't want God's will. They want their will. And therefore they pray for something. And you know, somebody who prays that God won't do his will when they know what his will is because they'd prefer he do something else, those people at that moment are frankly rebelling against the will of God. And so by giving them what they're asking, even though it's bad for them, God is sometimes, I guess, it's a discipline. Now, in your case, if you were sick, there's no reason you shouldn't pray to be well unless God had revealed to you that it's his will for you to die. I knew a woman dying of cancer, and she felt like God told her she's supposed to die of cancer, so she told us not to pray for her healing, and we didn't. But she was mistaken about the will of God. She actually was healed, and so she heard him wrong. But if someone is knows that God wants them to die, they shouldn't pray to be healed. Because if God does heal them, it may be disastrous, as it was for Hezekiah. I appreciate your call. I need to take a break. We have another half hour coming up. Don't go away. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener-supported. You can find out how to donate to this program to help us stand there by going to our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com under donate. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Don't go away.
The book of Hebrews tells us, do not forget to do good and to share with others. So let's all do good and share The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg with family and friends. When the show is over today, tell one and all to go to thenarrowpath.com where they can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. And be sure to tell them to tune into the show right here on the radio. Share listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share and do good.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour taking your calls. And our lines are full, and I don't know that you'll be able to get through in this half hour, but you can take the number down and try a little later. Lines do open up. The number is 844-484-5737. And in our first half hour, a caller called, and he was asking about Mormon teaching. Specifically about the fact that Jesus said in the resurrection there will be no marriage and, or giving in marriage. And the caller was asking me, how do the Mormons respond to that? Because they believe that there is marriage in the next life. And I said, I don't know, but I have a friend in Albany, Oregon named Mike, who is a Mormon for a long time. He's not anymore, but maybe he'll call and tell us. I see Mike from Albany on my line, so I'm going to assume that's my friend Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Steve. It's good to hear from you.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
I heard that call, and so I wanted to call in and just kind of explain how Mormons would understand that scripture. So what they will say is that Jesus was talking to people who wouldn't have been worthy to have eternal marriage anyways, and so because they're trying to entrap him and kind of just trip him up on his words, he told them something that was true in their case, but wouldn't be true for a Mormon who was obeying all the the new revelations that Mormons have. So
okay,
that's
so
essentially how they would.
They were saying that he was saying that they, the Sadducees, who were challenging him, were not going to marry in the resurrection because they would not be qualified. Whereas
a
Mormon religion, if you're a faithful Mormon, you're not in the same category with the Sadducees, so you would.
Right. That's generally how they would explain it, because they would say, you know, Jesus is, these people are trying to argue with him. He doesn't want to be argumentative, and so he's saying something that's technically correct in their case, but for people who follow him, he'll give them greater promises. But anyways, Mark 3, verse 35, I think, gives a better promise than anything Mormonism has. It says, whoever does God's will be my brother and sister and mother. So You know, Mormons believe that we can be in eternal family units if we jump through all the hoops of Mormonism, but Christ is telling us right then
we could be his family.
Him, we follow him. Yeah, we're in his family. So
that's a lot better.
Obviously we're all together. But anyway, I just wanted to call and clarify that and just say how you know, if you're talking to a Mormon, they have this, they have good family values, and that's great, but you can share with them that, you know, they are guaranteed, if they're in Christ, to be with their family forever. So,
well, I'm
with Christ, in Christ.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you called, because you are my resident expert on Mormonism, and I appreciate that. You know, it's interesting that they would explain it the way you said, because Jesus didn't say to the Sadducees in the resurrection, you will not marry. He said, they do not marry. And the question the Sadducees were asking wasn't actually about whether they would marry or not. They were talking about a case where a woman, following faithfully what the law said, had to marry the brother of her first husband because he died childless, and the law required her to marry his brother. And he died childless, and then she had to marry the next brother. And so their idea was, well, just by being faithful to God and keeping the law, she ended up married to seven different men in her lifetime. If there's a resurrection, how in the world is that going to work out? If they're all back, aren't they all going to want her? And so Jesus said, no, they don't get married in the resurrection. So in other words, the Sadducees are not really even asking about their own situation, and he doesn't address it to them. But that's, I can see that. I just recently read a book by Don Preston, who's a full preterist, a different kind of heresy, I think. And he wrote a book about this, and he believes that Jesus was not actually saying there's no marriage in the resurrection. And the convoluted logic he uses is really astonishing. You know, I mean, Jesus said it pretty clearly, but when people want to say something else, they can certainly find ways to ignore the text and impose on it a different meaning. I appreciate your expertise.
Well, yeah. So section 132 that talks about eternal marriage and Mormon, the LDS Doctrine and Covenants, it says that that people won't marry or get married after this life. They have to get married in this life, and then it'll stay if they do it the right way. So,
well, see, I've even heard Christians suggest that maybe that's what it means, that there won't be any new marriages contracted in the resurrection, but the marriages we have here will be. However, that doesn't work, because in the context, they're asking about people who were married in this life, and asking, who will she be married to then in the resurrection, since she was in this life married? You know, so even that skirts the issue. Yeah.
It doesn't really hold up, but so Joseph Smith wanted to marry a lot of women. And he was trying to make it sound like a reasonable religious thing to do. And so this is kind of what he came up with. I really, kind of the nail in the coffin for me with Mormonism was what Joseph Smith was doing. He was, he had two foster daughters. One was only 17, that he was telling as a prophet of God that she needed to marry and have sex with him. And lots of women he was telling that to, and really, really coercive. And it's all kind of based around that doctrine of eternal marriage, that he was able to convince people to do that. So,
and he even did it with other men's wives. He even did it with other men's wives while they were married, right?
Yeah, he had other women who were already married marry him as well.
Yeah.
The details on that are a little bit less. We don't have any details as to whether
Because Mormons say, they say sometimes they didn't consummate. Yeah, whatever. They're just bound.
Yeah, but we do know for sure that he was with many women, because they were testifying of it in court, and they were faithful Latter-day Saints, and they're, these women who were, some of them really young. Anyways, it's a big mess. But the teachings of Christ are that we get to be with him as one big family, and so there's no need to worry worry about any of that stuff. But
Well, thank you, Mike.
Thanks for your show, Steve. I appreciate it.
All right, great to hear from you. God bless. All right, let's talk next to Sharon from Warren, Michigan. Sherry, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Quick question before I ask my other question. Where can I find the Refuse to be Offended lectures again?
It's a little hard to find. At thenarrowpath.com, click on the link click on the link that says topical lectures, and then go down in alphabetical order. There's a category called individual topic. I think it says individual topics. And when you then click on that to let the window come down, it'll show you a list of, like, I don't know, 80 or more individual topics. And I think Refuse to be Offended is near the top of that list, like, I mean, number 5 or 6 or something like that.
Okay, I'm very familiar with your website. I know exactly what you mean. Maybe I didn't scroll down far enough because I did look there, but I'll look again. It's fine.
Okay.
How did they use the word salvation in the Old Testament? How would you define that?
In the Old Testament, salvation could mean any number of things, because it could mean simply deliverance or rescue. And so when God brought Israel out of Egypt, for example, he referred to that as saving them or their salvation. But when he brought them out of Babylon, out of captivity, that's also referred to as salvation. And David, when he in the Psalms, when he talks about his salvation, in many cases he's talking about how God delivered him out of the, you know, out of the miry clay and the pit and so forth, and or that his enemies had surrounded him, but God saved him. Salvation in the Old Testament, very often, maybe always, I can't really say for sure because the word is used quite a lot of times, but certainly I think most of the time it's referring to something earthly, in the sense of the person, the Jews were in imminent danger, and they escaped it by the grace of God. God saved them out of their trials. And so deliverance, delivering, and rescuing are concepts that are spoken of as salvation in the Old Testament. I don't know, honestly, of any particular, nothing comes to mind of a passage in the Old Testament where salvation to them would mean what it means to us in the New Testament. In the New Testament, of course, it says his name shall be called Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. And I'm not saying that idea is absent from the Old Testament, but I'm not sure if the word salvation is often used that way in the Old Testament. It usually means something temporal, like salvation from immediate troubles.
Okay, thank you. That's what I thought. I just wanted to clarify that in my own mind. We love your show.
Well, thank you, Sherry. I appreciate
thank
your
you,
call. Bye now. Joe from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So I'm calling because I am a former Jehovah's Witness. I'm not religious anymore. But one thing that I always kind of, I guess I don't quite understand about Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So when I look at like what's going on, it seems like there's a lot of harm caused by Christians. So how do you, as a Christian, promote Christianity just by the harm that's ongoing because of your religion, if that's okay to ask?
Sure, of course. Of course it is. First of all, I make a distinction between Christianity, which is a religious system, on the one hand, and a Christian. A Christian is a disciple of Jesus. That's the only way the term is used in the New Testament. It says in Acts 11:26, the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. So the only biblical definition of a Christian is someone who's a disciple of Jesus, and a disciple of Jesus is someone who's following Jesus. And Jesus said, by this all men will know you're my disciples, by your love for each other. He said that you have to love one another as I have loved you. And that, of course, the way Jesus loved is to sacrifice himself. He's referred to in the book of Hebrews as that Jesus is said to be holy and harmless and separate from sinners. Jesus told his disciples, be as harmless as doves, but as wise as serpents. So if a person's really a follower of Jesus, that means if they're really a Christian, they don't hurt people. I mean, you're right. Religion hurts people. Christopher Hitchens, of course, famously wrote his book, you know, God is Not Great, with the subtitle, How Religion Poisons Everything. You know, well, I don't agree that religion poisons everything. I think some people's lives are improved by religion, and even some people are made better people and more helpful to other people by religion. But I'm not in favor of religion. I'm in favor of following Jesus. Jesus didn't come to start a religion. he already, there was already a religion. He lived in, he lived his whole life and died under that religion, which is called Judaism. But when he did die, he fulfilled the old covenant and started a new order, what's called the new covenant. And that order was a family, not a religion. Jesus actually forbade his disciples, who were going to be the leaders of that family. He said, don't let anyone call you, rabbi or teacher or father. Your father is God, and you're all brothers. You have one teacher, Christ. And in other words, he wouldn't even allow his disciples to take on the role of religious leaders, but rather just brothers to everyone else. We have seen history, I think, pervert the movement of Jesus into a religious system that's now in competition with other major world religions like Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam, and Judaism, and so forth. And now there's Christianity. But the Bible never mentions Christianity. There's no mention of Christianity in the Bible. Only followers of Jesus. Now, I don't promote Christianity in that sense. I don't promote a religious system. I promote discipleship. That's what Jesus said we should do, is go and make disciples of all nations. And a disciple, Jesus said, if you continue in my words, then you are my disciples. Indeed. Indeed means really. There's a lot of people who claim to be his followers but are not. But he said, those who are indeed truly my disciples are those who continue in my words. And so, true Christianity, that is true discipleship, has led to tremendous benefits in society. Slavery in England and in America was abolished essentially through, Christian convictions being promoted by Christian advocates, and slavery finally was ended. Not all the people who participated in it were Christians, but those who spearheaded it were informed by Christian worldview, which no other, religion has. For example, Christianity and Judaism would be the only religions today that actually forbid slavery today, whereas Islam and Buddhism and Hinduism would not necessarily speak to those issues. What's that?
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I thought Paul had said something about if you're a slave, you should be a good slave, not
right.
forbidding
right.
slavery, but more that, work within the slavery system. Is that right?
Sure, yeah. And, he also said that they should submit to the government, which was Nero, a very pagan government. The Christians lived under certain circumstances that they were not able to change, and therefore they were supposed to not be discontented. They could serve God in those roles. And so he said in 1 Corinthians 7, if you're a slave, don't think anything about it. But if you have the power or the right to escape it, he said, use that. So you see that in 1 Corinthians 7, that he said, if you're a slave, that's probably something you can't help it. So just be content and serve God that way. And then he said, but if you get the opportunity to be free, then take advantage of that. So he's not saying they had to be slaves. He's saying that they should be content slaves if slaves is what they must be. Same thing with children or wives or anyone else that was under authority of someone else. They're supposed to be good children, good wives. But of course, any kind of oppression in the institution of the family or whatever was forbidden. And of course, Paul would prefer and even commanded that husbands sacrifice themselves for their wives and don't provoke their children. In other words, if everyone did what Paul said, whether they're husbands, wives, children, masters, slaves, there'd be no oppression. There'd be absolutely nothing where one person oppresses another. In fact, when Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians 13 that we are commanded to love one another, and that fulfills the whole law, he said, love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. So, by definition, being a follower of Jesus means you do no harm to anybody. Now, if someone says, but Christianity has done a lot of harm. Well, a religion that calls itself Christianity has done a lot of harm. Though, frankly, that same religion has done a lot of good, too. Not only slavery, but, the care of orphans, the care of the sick, the promotion of education, and lots of other benefits to society can be traced to influence of Christianity as a religion and to individuals within it who are actually true disciples of Jesus in many cases. I mean, there's a tremendous difference in what one would expect to develop in a society under Hinduism, for example, or even atheism, if there was no Christian influence at all, than what we actually see. For example, Mother Teresa was a Roman Catholic. I'm not, but she loved the Lord, and she was trying to follow Jesus. She went to India, which was a Hindu place, and nobody in India was taking care of the desperately poor. The lepers and so forth were dying in the streets. Rats were chewing at them. And she came in there as a Christian, and she began to care for them. And no one could understand why she would do that, because in the Hindu religion, you don't care for the sick. You don't help them, because they have bad karma. And you need to let them work off their bad karma so when they reincarnate next time, they'll come back in a better place. Christianity doesn't believe that. Christianity says, no, you only have one life here before the final one, and you are to help the poor. So, I mean, the Christian worldview actually has created hospitals, which didn't exist before, care for orphans, care for the poor. Christianity, even as a religion with its flaws, has done more good for the world than any other religion, and certainly more than atheists have done. Now, atheists say, you don't have to be a Christian or believe in God to be good. No, as long as you were raised in a Christian country, you probably have some Christian values, and you can be an atheist now and still hold those values, but you don't have any basis for them. The Christian values are based on a belief in Christ and God. Atheists, most of the ones who are writing books against Christianity, do not realize the degree to which the freedoms they have, the compassion that exists in the society they live in, is a pensioner on, its Christian heritage. They may personally decide they don't want to be Christians, they want to be atheists, and they say, well, I can still love my neighbor as I love myself. Yeah, but you wouldn't unless Christianity taught you to. That's the point. You know, atheism, left to itself, would simply follow the code of evolution, the survival of the fittest. After all, that's what they say is the universal code of the living world, is the survival of the fittest. If there was no Christianity to civilize them, well, they'd just be taking advantage of each other. And we know that because societies before Christianity came to them did those very things. So, you know, to say Christianity's been bad, I'd say Christianity's been good on balance for the world. But it has done some bad things, too, because there are people within that religious system who are in no sense followers of Jesus. And I don't recommend the system. I recommend Jesus and following him. By the way, I have to take some more calls if I can before, and we're almost out of time. I'd love to talk more to you. If you want to call another time early in the show, I'd love to talk more, but I would like to recommend something to you. And that is, I wrote some books last year called Empire of the Risen Son, which is about what I'm calling discipleship, what I'm calling the kingdom of God, what I advocate as opposed to institutional Christianity. And I would send you those books for free. I don't expect any unbeliever to buy my books. I don't make money on them anyway. But if you want to email me at steve@thenarrowpath.com and say, hey, I'm Joe from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who you're talking to, and I'd like to read your books, I'll send them to you tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Joe. Good talking to you.
Bye.
Bye now. Okay, Jacob from Puyallup, Washington. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I'd like to make a claim based on Matthew 5:19. Therefore, okay, whoever nullifies one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. So whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. So the claim or statement I'd like to make is that Jesus kept and taught the law or the commandments. Is that something you would agree with?
Well, Jesus taught that his disciples should keep the Jewish law until it's fulfilled. That's what the previous verse says. The previous two verses say that not one jot or tittle of the law will pass until all is fulfilled. So he's saying, therefore, if you're my disciple, I don't want you breaking the law until it's fulfilled. Of course, once it's fulfilled, we got to, look at the new system and see what that requires. But until then, and there were still several years between the time he spoke to them about this and the time he actually fulfilled it through his death, they had to live some way. He said, listen, don't think I'm here to destroy the law and the prophets and you can just ignore them. No, if you ignore them, then you'll be the least in my movement. You won't have any status in my movement. But
what about the fact that the kingdom of heaven is actually something that is already here?
Yeah, he was introducing the kingdom of heaven, but he hadn't fulfilled the law yet. He did that in his crucifixion. He had not brought the new covenant yet until he did in the upper room with his disciples. So the old covenant was still in force. You know, it says in Hebrews 8 that when the new covenant comes, it makes the old covenant obsolete. So the old covenant was not obsolete until the new covenant came. And that and the law and the prophets, that was the old covenant stipulation. So Jesus, living with his disciples under the old covenant for 3.5 years, told them, I don't want you to just ignore the law. Now, on the other hand, Jesus did say that he was the Lord of the Sabbath and that he actually did things that most Jews criticized him for doing on the Sabbath. He also touched lepers. He also touched dead bodies. He also let a woman with an issue of blood touch him. All of this would be forbidden in the law. So, I mean, Jesus, although he was kind of the transitional guy, he already was the new covenant man, but he hadn't instituted the new covenant until his death. And therefore, he had the right to do things that God has the right to do. And that's what he said when they criticized Jesus for doing his healings on the Sabbath, which was the work he did every other day. And the Sabbath law said, you do your regular work 6 days and don't do it on the Sabbath. But he did anyway. He did his regular work on the Sabbath as well as the other 6 days. He said, well, the reason I do that is because my Father works every day. And I'm his follower. I follow him. I see what my Father does. The Son can only do what he sees the Father do. I see my Father working every day. So that's what I do. So he indicated that he had some special, of course, authority as the Son of God to do certain things that other people at that point were not yet entitled to do. I appreciate your call. If we have a few minutes left, we want to talk to Oscar from Mount Vernon, New York. Oscar, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Well, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Exodus 5, verse 21, mm-hmm. It says, and the Lord said to Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you do all those wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in your hand. But mm-hmm. I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. So my question is, did God harden his heart in order to accomplish his plan of salvation?
Yes, exactly. He hardened Pharaoh's heart, well, not mm-hmm. just to accomplish the, certainly it was associated with the Exodus. He could have gotten Pharaoh to let them go earlier, and he could have saved Israel without hardening Pharaoh's heart. I mean, if God didn't harden Pharaoh's heart, he would have let the people go sooner. So in a sense, hardening Pharaoh's heart postponed the salvation. That would have he's preventing Pharaoh from letting them go earlier than God wanted them to. Because God was, in addition to saving Israel from Pharaoh, he was also interested in punishing Pharaoh and the Egyptians. So there were two things going on there. In chapter 12 of Exodus, God said he was judging the gods of Egypt through these plagues. And Pharaoh was one of those gods of Egypt. So the thing is that God, punishing Pharaoh and getting him to release the people was the plan of salvation for Israel to escape in the Exodus. However, actually what God did is prevented Pharaoh from letting them go right away. Because he wanted first to adequately and justly punish the Egyptians for their years of oppression and murder and evil that they had done against Israel. So God didn't want him to get it off too easy. So he hardened Pharaoh's heart for 10 plagues so that Pharaoh would, of course, have to suffer before he let them go. Hey, I'm out of time for the show, Oscar, but I hope that helps you. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live Monday through Friday for an hour each day. And we've been doing this for a long time. And we pay for the time on radio stations. It's very expensive. We're listener supported. You won't find anything for sale at our website or on the air. We don't have sponsors. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.